Hi, my name is Bernard Baltex. What follows is a 35-minute podcast taken from the IMR program at this summer's convention in Las Vegas. The original program was over an hour and a half. We've reduced it down to about 30 minutes with a few comments and introductions by me. You may listen to this podcast on its own or in conjunction with the written materials, which are available on the website and include the PowerPoint slides and the IMR flowchart. The pages referred to by the speakers are usually to the PowerPoint program. The podcast begins with an introduction from Sherry Grant.
My name is Sherry Grant, and as Mark has told you, I am one of the founding partners of Gordon Edelstein. Now pay attention, I'm only going to say this name once. Gordon Edelstein, Kripak, Grant, Goldstein, and Felton. We are very proud to be Southern California lawyers, trying to be the best that we can be, but we're also very proud to be members of CA, because without CA and all the resources that CA presents to us, we believe we are inextricably intertwined, all of you, CA, and us. And we hope to share this knowledge with you, which is a collective experience of all of CA's brains, CA's courage, CA's heart, and our heart, courage, and brains together.
The next speaker is Erica Vargas. She discusses UR validity issues and how to handle them in conjunction with the IMR process. The recommendation is to challenge UR validity in court, but to simultaneously request IMR. If you have further questions about UR validity, see practice tip number 8, which is available on the website.
Me. Hi. Okay, so Sherry's bringing up our slideshow, and you can follow along also in your materials on page 1031 and also the flowchart on 1026. And we will try to correspond what we're saying with the slideshow as best as we can. So I wanted to tag onto the prior panel a little bit and talk a little bit about utilization review, and they did a really fantastic job talking about the different ways to, on its face, point out to you ways that you can go to court because the utilization review was invalid. And they broke it down nicely, and so I don't want to be repetitive, but it's really important that you guys scrutinize these URs. This is going to be a place that we can remedy, I guess, go to court, get the treatment, and before even the IMR process goes on automatic pilot, which I think in the next few months we're going to have to start doing, take the extra step back, read the URs. Again, it's going to be a way to get to court. And the prior panel mentioned the Corona case, but there's also Becerra, and that's in your materials as well on page 1319. You know, that supports if there is a validity issue in your utilization review denial, file for a hearing. It's going to be a trial expedited request. And it's important that you get it before the courts, you lay out what the issues were for validity and the reason why you should get your treatment authorized. Another thing in Becerra I thought that was important is, while not en banc, the panel decision did indicate that for your time spent gathering materials, fighting, writing letters, demanding that the treatment should be authorized on a validity issue, that as attorneys, our efforts should be rewarded. So they do talk about attorney fees in that case, and I think it's really important is a lot of this process now is, well, it's going to be a lot of fighting for not a lot of money. I mean, where are we going to get paid? We're going to be doing a lot of work, as we'll talk about. What it takes to get through the IMR process is timely. It's costly. But we don't get paid for it. So, I mean, the cost benefit in that is getting your client's treatment, hopefully, expeditiously through this IMR process. But, you know, it's also nice to know that if you're fighting for something that they did wrong, that should have been right, our efforts should be rewarded at court. So Becerra is an interesting case that provides for that, and I think you guys should read that, and it's really important, and you should make those arguments. You know, we don't fight for free, I guess I like to say. So a lot of people
have I taught her well?
you know, a lot of people have asked me questions in preparation for this panel is, you know, you have a valid UR denial. You know you're not going to be going to court immediately as a remedy. So then what do I do under this new SB 863? Well, we've had a lot of conversations about this, and we think it's very clear that you send a letter to the defense attorney, which you've probably already been doing this if you have a validity issue. You demand that they authorize the treatment, and you simultaneously file for your expedited hearing. You get to court. So the next question is, under IMR, am I going to be also processing the application? And I know the question came up right at the very end of the last panel, and I agree with the responses that they said is, you should concurrently file your IMR application. Why? There's a 30-day time frame here. You get to court. What if you happen to lose? What if you blow the timelines? It's not so good for your client. It's an oops. So I like to say, to be safe, file them both, get to court, but also sign that IMR application, and Amy will go through how to do that. Best thing, you prevail at court, the judge awards your treatment. But worst thing is, you didn't file the IMR application and you lose, your client's not going to get what he needs. So another thing is, if you do prevail at court and you happen to have simultaneously filed the IMR application and it comes back negatively, we don't think that the IMR decision trumps what happens at court. So we just want to make that clear because a few people have asked that question. So in the chart, or in the flow chart actually, there is a triangle shape that actually breaks down in different ways as a reminder and a tag on to the prior panel of ways to invalidate the UR. So you guys can read that at your leisure, but so I wanted to point that to you. So I don't really have anything else to say on this actual topic. I think the prior panel covered a lot of the issues. But the main thing I want to tell you is, fill out every IMR application that comes with your UR. You must. If you have a simultaneous UR validity issue, process them both. You don't want to blow any timelines. That's what I have to say about that.
The next speaker is Amy Leung. She discusses the Code of Regulations sections that pertain to IMR and what to do when you get the IMR application from the claims adjuster.
Basically, Labor Code 4610 says that the employee may submit a request for IMR no later than 30 days after the service of the UR decision. And that's, you know, service is a term of art, and that's going to, you know, in our opinion, include the mailbox rule of 5 days. Then the regs, 9792, state that the objection to the UR must be communicated in the app within 30 days of receipt of the decision. So I'm gonna play it safe. I'm not gonna wait until the 29th, 30th, 31st day to, you know, have to argue this. And let's see. This form that you have right here is the proposed permanent form, and there's a slight changes, but note that the fax number at this point is the same, but the address does change between the emergency and the permanent. The emergency is to Folsom, and then the permanent, proposed permanent is to Sacramento. So at this point in time, we're sending it to Folsom until the permanent one gets adopted.
And just be reminded, you've heard this here during the weekend, but what you're operating under now are temporary emergency regulations. So when asked on the prior panel what form, what we've been told, and when I went to the original open community, basically we were told that use what is in effect now, and that when the new regs come, whenever they come, so we don't know, I don't totally believe when they say they're coming, just operate as if you are under these temporary regulations until you're told otherwise.
When you receive this application, you or your staff is going to have to review it very carefully. It's the rules say that they have to fill it all out completely except for the signature. So that might be, you know, a point of litigation if they didn't fill it out completely. But, you know, they're definitely making mistakes from the ones we've received already. There's a couple key parts where they're, you need to review, make sure that the request for the RFAs, the certain sections mirror the what they reviewed in UR, and that is mirrored in what's stated on the IMR application. And if you, I guess, the I think the rules say that if you have any changes, you can write it on a separate piece of paper and include it. So we're going to write a cover letter, and if there's any, you know, changes we're going to make, we're going to highlight those as well. Let me talk about what is going to be included in this IMR application you're sending. The first thing, obviously, is the application. And the second thing that you must include is the UR decision to modify, delay, or deny. If you don't include that, then it's going to get kicked back to you to include it. And the other thing that needs to be included, and this is what we've been doing in our practice, is that the regs basically say you can, the employee can designate an agent to go through the IMR process, but that designation has to happen after the UR decision. So that's, we're basically tagging on an additional page and saying that we're designating our, you know, the employee is designating us as the agent for the purposes of IMR, and that will get the IMR Maximus with our correct firm name, and they better CC us on everything.
Now be careful about this, because we've received some telephone calls from clients in their in this early phase where in fact we were the last to know. And so we have created some new forms, which over the next several months, and at the end I'm going to tell you about a COS September panel just on IMR, and in our firm, and I think people up and down the state, are creating forms. And in the original form, we are going to have, and we've already started, put a designation of our firm so that we are putting them on notice that they must communicate with us.
The proposed permanent application also comes with a second page, if you'll look in the website, and that is a designation form, and it basically has a place for signature for the injured worker and for us. So I think you should pull that out from the website and start using it in your initial intake to the, with the new clients, and have them sign that right then and there so you can have it in the file to use in the future. So you're going to include, well, we have samples in our packet of the entire packet that we sent to Maximus and to IMR. Another point is that Dr. Weiss, the project director at Maximus, did come down and talk to Ka in May, and there's a slideshow in your materials that you, that's really helpful, and it's also posted on the DWC website, and so it's coming from Maximus telling us how do they plan on doing this. There's a lot of contact information in there, and they conveyed to, he conveyed to us that it's important that your law firm have a point of contact so that if they want to contact us in, for any additional information in an expedited manner, they're not going to have to go through snail mail. And so we've changed our letterhead when we're sending stuff to Maximus and IMR AD to have a point of contact. We just have one person, one e-fax number, and then when anything comes in from Maximus, then that our staff person is going to email the prospective other staff person to respond. So that's what we have set up. I don't know if it, you know, we'll see if all that works out well. Anything else to attach? I think not at this point. We definitely need to obviously CC the defense attorney and the we CC the treating the physician that's requesting it so that they're on notice that we're doing this. We're filing the IMR app. And then we also CC the applicant so that they know what's going on. And obviously, if the it's a consult doctor that's making the request, we're going to CC the consult doctor and the PTP. At this point in time, the treating doc the doctor that's requesting is going to be aware that there's a UR decision that's moving forward, and they're encouraged to issue a rebuttal to the UR at this time so that it can be, you know, come into the packet that's going to be sent to IMR for review. The only way IMR is going to work is if they have all the information, and the better the information, the better it complies with the MTUS, the better. So if there's any vagueness at all about that, then it needs to be clarified up front. So a rebuttal to it, it would be fabulous, and at this point in time would be the time to start doing it.
The next speaker is Joanna Sakovich. She discusses what the administrative director does when the IMR application is received.
You might think that you put a request in for the IMR review and that it automatically gets reviewed by the IMR. Of course, this is not the case. The AD acts as a gatekeeper here, and in fact, the AD filters through these requests, and the AD determines whether it is IMR worthy. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about what the AD has to review and look for before it decides whether it's IMR worthy, and then passes it on to the IMR or sends you notification that, in fact, it is not and it will not be assigned to an IMR. The first thing that the AD needs to look for, pursuant to 9792.10.3, the AD looks at four categories of eligibility requirements before it makes her final decision. First, she looks to make sure that it was timely and that it was filled out properly. Now, the person who's filling this out originally is the adjuster, and we know they never, ever, ever make mistakes. But if that should happen to not be true, you might want to take a close look at it and correct those mistakes, unless you want the whole thing to get held up. So take
fix
a look.
Fix it.
Fix it. You can actually write on it, they didn't check this, that you know has to be checked, just check it. That way it's not going to get stuck at the AD filter process. So after you do that, and the AD determines that all that is correct, the AD is going to look to see if this request was already requested within the last 12 months. And as you've heard, seemingly, you get one shot, the one doctor gets one shot to get this approved, and if it's denied by IMR, he or she cannot ask for it for an entire year. Now, that's not necessarily the case. It's not as absolute as that, and I believe Attorney Thomas might have mentioned this earlier. There's wiggle room there, and I'm going to go over that in a second. So,
not exactly as they say in the Hertz commercial. There's always a way for us to find.
Absolutely. And it's kind of a fun thing that we can talk about, if there's any fun in this. Just give me 1 second to get to that part. Here we go. So, per Regulation 4610G6, the denial will remain in effect for 12 months from the date of the decision with regard to the recommendation of the same treatment by the same physician unless, here's the good part, the recommendation is supported by a documented change in the facts material to the basis of the UR decision. What does that really mean? What's the practice tip here? There is an exception to the 12-month rule. You get a second bite at the apple, you and the doctor. You can point out some things that might have been missed or left out and actually get to apply for it again, because that would be a material change. And we're going to have to work closely with the doctors in this area, but we're going to use this to not let this be used as another block and another sword against denying treatment. We're going to be proactive, as all of you are, work with the doctors, and if it's something that's material facts that gives us a second shot at this, let's get it done. Now, the next thing after we're looking at the 12-month rule is the AD is going to actually review the liability issue that's come up many times here today, and that is this even something that an IMR should be reviewing? Because the adjuster's not even liable here. We shouldn't even be here because the injury is denied or the part of body's denied. And as we know, denied injuries aren't so bad. We don't have to go through this IMR process. We just go treat with our doctor on a lien and we deal with it later. So the AD will look and make sure that there's no liability issue here. 1 second. The last thing that the AD looks at, and I quote, is any other reason that it shouldn't be reviewed. All right, well, what does that mean? Perhaps we are fighting that the UR denial was not proper in the first place, and hence we shouldn't be here on this track. And but we did talk about during this panel that we are both simultaneously going to go to the board and fight that the UR was invalid, but we're also going to file our IMR application to protect our timelines. And this is something that the AD would look at. And I suppose the practice tip here would be write a cover letter to the AD and let them know, hey, yeah, we're applying here, but we're also down at the WCAB because we shouldn't really be here in the first place, don't you agree? This is the UR wasn't even valid, but to cover our bases, we filed. So the AD is going to look at that.
Now we would consider that if they don't do it right, we would ask you all to think about whether that's an unreasonable delay of medical care with all that carries with it.
Absolutely. Now, all of that is done, and one of two things happen. First, the AD notifies the parties within one business day that it has been assigned to an IMR, one business day. Okay? A sample of that is in your materials on page 1299, because we have had several of these in our office already. And I've had clients come and meet me, and the process has already been started, and I was never notified, and I had nothing to do with it. So as Sherry stated earlier, it's chaos right now. So the IMR is going to tell you within one business day that it's been assigned, and now you're off to the IMR. Alternatively, the AD, our little gatekeeper, she's going to say, you know what, it's not eligible, and it's going to be rejected. Parties do have the right to appeal that determination by, quote unquote, filing a petition with the WCAB. We're not exactly sure what that means, but that is what the code says.
Will the real commissioners please stand up? Will the judge please stand up? Is it a recon? Is it a brief? Is it a formal request? I think we're just going to have to try. You know, that whole thing about let a hundred flowers bloom, as they say in Chinese. So I think that you need to, in this situation, understand the words, but basically decide together what the procedure will be. I think that by use of the word WCAB, it's like, well, the real WCAB, please stand up. I mean, who is that? The use of the word commissioners seems to imply that you can't just go to the court step door. But again, I think we're just going to have to play that one by ear.
All right, so let me leave you with this. The eligibility filter is not meant to impede the process of getting IMR review. Publicly, the administration has said that that is not their intent, and so let's not let that happen. The point here is that we're the best attorneys in Munchkin land. We know what to do. We're going to be proactive. We are going to be advocates. We're going to work with the doctors. And we're not going to allow this to be used as another sword to deny our clients the treatment that they need. Thank you.
We're now going back to Erica Vargas to discuss Labor Code Section 4610.5 and specifically what claims adjusters must send to Maximus once the AD refers the matter to Maximus.
Expedited and non-expedited, I just want to clarify, and I know in our chart, the flow shows that there are different paths to go down for time frames. So it's really important when you're dealing with expedited versus a regular review, non-expedited review, that you're aware of all the timelines. So Labor Code 46106 D does provide, in my opinion, a broad definition of what is considered to be serious, and I believe they've discussed it on the prior panel, so I won't repeat it, but once you are in something called an expedited review, well, first, how do you get there, and how do you know what that is? The RFA. It must be filled out correctly. Well, who fills out the RFA? The doctors. So you get the RFA, you review it. If you happen to believe that it was filled out incorrectly by the doctor, call your doctor, communicate with your doctor. don't just fix the form, because I don't think that does anybody any good to just change the form that was filled out by your own doctor. Have a conversation, figure out why they checked what they did. You want to make sure, as Amy said, the application for IMR will be filled out by the claims examiner. They're going to follow the RFA, in theory. You want to make sure it's accurate and that both match. Because when you're in an expedited review situation, the timelines are very, very tight for both sides. So, and really quick, you guys can refer to 9792.10.5C, and that breaks down the period of if Maximus determines that it's a regular review, and they need further information from you beyond what you've already sent them, you have 5 business days to respond. If it's considered an expedited review, it is only 1 business day. Once all the materials are in front of Maximus, and it's considered a regular review, per 9792.10.6G, they have 30 days from receipt of all materials and the application to make their final determination. If it's considered expedite, they have 3 days. So keep that in mind. I think that's all I have to say about those two, but just know what path you're on. I think it's critical to not blow any of these timelines. And that's all I have to say on that.
In this next section, Erica continues briefly to talk about the different rules between an expedited review and a regular review, and what the cost of the UR system is to the insurance carrier.
Once all the materials are in front of Maximus, and it's considered a regular review, per 9792.10.6G, they have 30 days from receipt of all materials and the application to make their final determination. If it's considered expedite, they have 3 days. So keep that in mind. I think that's all I have to say about those two, but just know what path you're on. I think it's critical to not blow any of these timelines. One final thing we wanted to bring up is the cost of IMR. Not that we're so concerned about it because it's not on us. However, some things to consider. Per 9797.10.8 governs the cost, at least in the emergency regs, and doesn't look like the proposed permanent is going to change that. These costs are for the insurance company, and for 2013, a regular review is going to cost $560 for each application, and for an expedited, $685. So do you really want to put all the UR denial stuff on one? Anyway, let's build it up. 2014, the costs go down.
It's their law, not ours.
I know.
We didn't make it up.
We just have to get creative. Regular review is $495 and expedited is $595. So it is calendared by year. You know, one other thing, though, the cost does decrease if you have a withdrawn review. Let's say they actually authorized the treatment. Yay. After they started the IMR process. This must happen before they get the additional materials that I spoke about earlier. Once they get the materials, all the records, everything to review, the cost remains the same as a full review cost. If the insurance company informs Maximus, and we think it's on them, that they're going to approve the treatment, the cost will still, it will drop, but it will be $215. So, motivation to pick up the treatment, perhaps? I don't know. You know, really all I want to say is that it's going to cost time, money, staff. You know, it's a lot of people to get this right, and it's going to, you know, we're just hoping that they're going to think about the cost analysis and all of this. Have they ever? No. But our hope is that it's costly and that maybe they will actually, for once, authorize the small treatment that's being requested to move them along and get these people the treatment that they need.
In this next short section, Sherry Grant briefly touches on the medical utilization treatment schedule, or MUTUS.
MTUS. Medical treatment utilization schedule. My new favorite word, MTUS.
You've heard some in the previous panels about M2s. They are the medical treatment utilization schedule that they're not saying it, but we know that that's what Maximus is using. And in looking at the IMR decisions that have come out to date, we see that they are absolutely following these protocols. So again, if you look in the materials, the website right there. And if you go on the website, you'll find pages and pages and pages. Now, I remember several years ago, I went to the very first ACOM seminar, and then I go and, you know, silly me, I'm looking at the statute, 863, and it deletes, you know, incorporation of ACOM. And then, okay, fine, because ACOM's really not for chronic use. I mean, everybody knows that, right? So then you go and you look at MUTUs, and what have they done? They incorporate a bunch of ACOM. So don't think you don't need to know ACOM any longer, but now you're doing it in the yellow brick road of MUTUs. And you can find the information on the website, and there's hundreds of pages of the chronic pain.
This last brief section deals with penalties.
Let me talk a little bit about penalties. If you read through the labor code, there's a lot of information about different penalties that the claims administrators are going to be held liable for if they delay the process. And it's very, very detailed. And Regulation 9792.12 is like two pages full of all these various situations that penalties can arise. But the labor code also says, for basically, the employer shall not engage in conduct to delay the IMR process. It's not to exceed $5,000 for each day when they don't properly notify the employee of their IMR rights. It could be $5,000 for each day. And also, if they don't authorize the services after our IMR decision, it's not to exceed $5,000 each day. But it's laid out. For example, if they fail to respond to an RFA, that's $1,000. If they fail to communicate the UR decision, that's $250 a day. So basically, these penalties get paid to the administrator, the workers' comp administrating revolving fund, so it doesn't get paid to you or your the injured worker. But we need to, the only way the AD is going to find out about these unreasonable delays is if we point them out. So in practice, we're going to use those delays as part of our Labor Code 5814 penalties petitions, and then we're going to point out the different regulations and labor codes that they violated as part of our 5814 penalty, and we're going to CC that to the administrative director. Otherwise, how are they going to, you know, start the process of imposing these penalties?
We have been asked to extend for a few more minutes for answering questions, but before we do that, I just want to give you some information on upcoming further events. We actually just began the dialogue today, and we hope all together we continue it. There is a CAS seminar on IMR September 21st, and we all recommend that you be happy to join all of us and participate. I think you will learn a lot more. We will know a lot more when some of this gets sorted out.
That was our podcast on IMR. We plan more of these in the future, so if you liked it, please let us know. And if you didn't, let us know what we can do better. Also, if you have more questions about IMR, please remember the IMR seminar September 21st in Berkeley and Los Angeles. Thank you for listening.